Thank you, everybody. My name is Sandy Beecher, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really excited to be here and see everybody. I appreciate the invitation. When Dick called, I was really happy that I could work it in. My friend John came with me. He helped me travel. I'm getting better, but I'm still going a little bit like this. Dick and Peggy wanted me to make an announcement before I got started. Peggy Martin has been sober longer than I have. So actually, that was just to steal her thunder from tomorrow. I got sober on Pearl Harbor Day in 1964 in Washington, D.C., and I had the best sponsor in the world. You know, I talk a lot about Chuck Chamberlain as being such an influence on my life. It's just been amazing. But I forget to mention that there's another man from Southern California that is of equal importance, and his name is Clancy. This is what I learned from him. Fall in love with AA, with all of you, with everything you got. And learn and fall in love with the AA message, with everything that you got. And then take this message with every ounce of strength and every skill that you possess, and take it to the blind eyes and the deaf ears of alcoholics all over the world, until by some miraculous way you get those ears to open and those eyes to open, and they see the light, and they see the hope, and you grab their hand, and you take them home. That's a big lesson, and Clancy, thank you very much for that. And his skill was in, you can't explain spirituality directly. You have to do it through stories and fables, and he was the master. I watched all that, and I saw how it worked. I saw how powerful it was, and it's just been a wonderful pleasure. I guess we're getting old. You got to say all these things just in case. Anyway, before I get started, I want to talk about my daughters, and then I'll get going on my regular story. I want to thank everybody. I know probably in this audience there were many of you that sent cards and phone calls and prayers. In my living room, I have two baskets, and they're both filled with cards from all over in Europe, and from AA groups and from individuals. And there's one from an Al-Anon group in Alaska where everybody in the group signed it and sent it down. And you thank those people up there, really. And I have the memorial services of each daughter with their picture on it on top of all those cards. And that's very sacred ground in my living room, are those two baskets. And in any way, my youngest daughter, Barbie, who had 5 years in AA, was murdered on March 3rd, and she came home from taking her daughter to high school, and somebody was waiting and really did her in and took her around the side and covered her up with some pillows from lawn furniture. And my middle daughter found her later that morning, and she's also an AA, Conway, and she's my hero. She has 9 years, and she handled everything. She called me, she called the family, she called the police, the press. She dealt with, I mean, just here's somebody 12 years ago, we didn't know where she was. And here she is, the strength of the family with her three brothers. And it was just remarkable. And she's coming down to Tampa in less than 2 weeks, and we're going to hang out for a whole week. We're going to talk together at one of our home groups down there and then go to the Tampa Fall Roundup. So I'm really looking forward to that. And then on June 2nd, 3 months later, my oldest daughter died of alcoholism. And her name was Catherine, and she has 4 boys, one in college, 3 in high school. My younger daughter had 2 children, one boy in college and one in high school. And my middle daughter, Conway, has now become the guardian of that daughter. And she was way off, and somehow she's bringing her back into reality. And it's just amazing to watch all this. My oldest daughter was very ill at the memorial service. And so my daughter, Conway, and I, we went. We said, boy, this we got to get her in now. This is they've been trying to make overtures, but the family didn't want us in there. No, there's no problem. There's no problem. But it was obvious. And that disease was so strong that when I said I was going to come up to Virginia, she said, if you do, I'll call the police. That's how strong this disease is. And it wasn't going to happen. So anyway, the reason I want to share this is to tell you how I handled it. When my daughter called me and said, are you sitting down? And I said, no. I said, oh, somebody got drunk. Normal thing you think of in AA. And so then she said, well, Barbie's been murdered this morning. Now, as she was saying those words, I thought, I have some experiences in my life that are invaluable, so I'm going to pass them on. Up in Washington, D.C., about 20 to 25 years ago, I don't know exactly how long, I was watching the local news, and on the news, they were interviewing, there had been one teenage kid had shot another one, and this very calm mother was being interviewed. It was her son that had been shot that morning. And the reporter asked her how she felt about the boy that did the shooting. And she said, I've already forgiven him. And she was totally calm, totally in possession of herself. And I remember looking over there going, boy, I hope I get to that spiritual level someday. I had never heard of it. I didn't know that that was even humanly possible. But I sure watched it, and I talked about it all the time. I would tell other people in AA, I can't believe what I saw there. It just was amazing. And then maybe about 15 years ago, somebody told me about a woman in AA who did the same thing. And then I saw the Amish. We all did. On television and the shooting, and the family went over to the parents of the boy that did the shooting to see if they could comfort them on the same day that it happened. And so what I saw out of that is the real power of forgiveness and acceptance comes when it's done with the event, when it's done at the time of the event. And so as my daughter was talking to me, I thought about that. And I just somehow just said, well, from this day forward, my relationship with this daughter is on a new level. As of this second, I will relate to her through memories and stories. And I can tell stories about her forever. And she was the chairman of the New Haven Convention. I was a speaker, and my other daughter introduced me. So I have wonderful stories about her. And then I forgave whoever did it. Without realizing it, I had eliminated resentment, anger, and hatred from this situation. And I was left with just sorrow. And sorrow God helps us with. He doesn't help us with resentment or hatred or anger. You're on your own. Because it was your choice to find this unacceptable or to be angry at or to hate someone. And so the burden was remarkably light in terms of suffering. And the sadness is still there, but I just have to turn to God and I feel comforted with it. So I just passed that on. And then with my oldest daughter, which we kind of knew was coming, and again, my middle daughter was there. She was in, boy, when that cirrhosis kicks in and the kidneys go out, it's a very bad death. And she was there and reporting to me. I was having a hard time traveling. When I finally got the news, some other speaker had inspired me to react initially in the following way, to turn to God and say, I just want you to know that I love you more than anything in the world. And this event will not change how much I love you. And then I stayed there with this connection for a few minutes, and then I decided to look and see how I felt about the event. And again, I was incredibly comforted because I was turning with God to look at this and see that this is a powerful disease and she's at peace now. And so I just passed these on because those are important lessons and they may serve a good purpose sometime. Okay, now I can go on and have some fun. Okay, thank you. Anyway, I grew up in New England and born in 1931. I'm going to speed it up because I want to talk about AA near the end. So only talk about every other drink. The most important event of my childhood was World War II. I mean, that was the dominating thing. When I look back, well, what do you think about this? And that was it. And it started when I was 11, and it ended when I was 15. And, all the relatives were in World War II. The country was totally united. Everybody was seeing who could sacrifice more than the other person. Rationing, pull the blinds and the airway boards to walk around at night. There's light sneaking through your living room window, and they'd knock on your door. Submarines are off the East Coast, and my mother was an air spotter. She was up on a hill. Every airplane that flew over, she called in and talked to somebody. About every 3 weeks, she'd go back through her kitchen and see if there was another pot or pan she could take over the center of town and throw it in the chicken wire enclosure where they were collecting pots and pans to make bullets and other things, airplane wings. And as the war went on, the kitchen, it was just getting down to about three items that you could cook with, but it didn't bother her because everybody else was doing it. It was such a terrible thing, but a uniting force. Everyone knew that if they didn't hang together real close, this could be fatal. Reminds me of AA. That's what holds us together, is that common enemy that if we don't stick together, we're not going to make it. And then we have the common solution of sacrifice for others that is such a powerful lesson. And I don't think the country could possibly ever get that close again unless some aliens invaded us or something. And so I miss it. I miss that, but it was a terrible time. But it also was a wonderful time in terms of human beings treating each other in a certain way. And so that's a big memory. Now, the other memory I have is of the Catholic Church. So now we're into another story. I have one sister, and she's got 33 years in AA, but she has stage 4 liver cancer, so we need some more prayers. She's up in Connecticut, and what a great sister, my God. And we both went to the same church. She still goes because she fell in love. She said, this is the nicest place. It's the safest place. These little cute nuns, they come around. Oh, I love the incense. Oh, I love the Latin. I can hardly wait to go to confession and get rid of these things. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. I, on the other hand, sitting right next to her, did not see it that way. I saw it quite different. It was something like a prison camp. And these little nuns with their Nazi outfits were not... They did not have my interest at heart. And I grabbed my ear, and I'm over here. You're going to go to... And the incense, I thought, was to cloud your mind. They would get you. And the Latin, who knew what they're saying? They could be saying in Latin, Dominus Ipsum, and it means get that little kid down. That's what that means. And then the confessional, I knew they were gathering evidence for later. You better not give them too much. So I had a hard time thinking up anything. Well, Father, I don't know. Maybe I got a little angry. And, well, son, you must have done. No, Father, that's all I can think of. So I got no comfort in there. And the God that I saw, which isn't the one they were teaching about, was frightening. And I never went to him for anything. see my difference from my sister. And it's all a question of perception. That's how I saw it. But how you see it is how it is. That's what you live with. That's the hard, cold facts of your life, is how you chose to, you didn't choose it, you just saw it that way. Around 10, I had polio, and I was very lucky to get the Sister Kenny treatment worked, and I had both right arm and leg. I couldn't move them, and they got most of the movement back, and that was a blessing. I liked athletics. I was smart. I went to a little prep school. I was on all these different teams, and it was a pipeline right into Yale University, which is in the center of New Haven, where I'd worked on the buildings. I did a lot of construction and climbing up on towers and all that, steeplejacking. I loved heights and danger and all that kind of stuff. But when I showed up as a student, I went, uh-oh. These guys, I don't know who they are. They're all rich. And there were, you know, famous names. And I'm looking around going, I better get out of here. I don't belong in here. I am, oh, jeez, I felt out of place. Just awful. And I didn't drink because I wanted to keep getting high grades. And my roommates, oh, you ought to be drinking. No, no. And every story I talk about it, my name was on the list. I had to go meet 30 guys in some room, socialize. That was like combat to me. I just go up and put your hand out and go, hello? I mean, so I got in there and I started looking around, taking the temperature of the room, and I looked at people's eyes, and I could see all 30 eyes said, we don't want to know you. It was clear. So I didn't know where to move, that, you know, so much rejection. So I went over. I didn't meet anybody. I started towards a few groups and then got overcome with something. So I went back to the bar and I said, maybe I will have a drink. And I ordered a drink, talking to the bartender. I'm waiting, supposed to make you feel good. And I had 2.5 drinks. And I think I was getting ready to leave. I said, I'm waiting. I don't see anything. So I turned around to go, and there it was. 30 of the friendliest guys you've ever seen were sitting there. And they're all looking at me going, would you please come over and be our friend? Would you please? And I didn't know where to start, over here, over there. And I just, wow, is this exciting? All these new friends are standing right there waiting for me. And I started walking over to the first group. I had a lot of jokes ready and everything. And on my way over there, I found myself agreeing with them. They would be lucky to know me. And it was like all my anxiety was gone, so my true self could come out. Blah, 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 blah. It was just amazing. It went on and on and on and on. And they're starting to leave. I'm going, where are you going? Where are you going? And pretty soon they're all gone. So I went back to the bar and I went, God, 2.5 drinks did that. What will 20 drinks do? Might as well find out. So I went through that first experience with drinking a lot, which involved lying on the bathroom floor and dry heaving and puking. And, oh, God, it was awful. And the next morning, sitting there feeling like your head had been split open with a hatchet. And the thought occurred to me, are you going to drink again tonight? And within a half a second, I went, yes. I mean, it was, yes. I said, this hatchet in my head is a small price to pay for what I had last night. That's an alcoholic. Incredible suffering is okay as long as you get what alcohol gave me, which was a new world to live in. Non-alcoholics have some fun with alcohol. We are transformed into a new planet, a new way of life, and a new way of seeing ourselves. So for us, it's worth the price. And the other people don't understand it. So anyway, the grades started going out the window. The athletics went out the window. I started getting in fights, started getting arrested. And by the time graduation came, I made it by 1/100th of a decimal out of there. Years later, I looked at my grades and I put them back. I said, I'm never looking at those again. That was awful. The Korean War was still going on. Everybody had to join. The draft was on, so everybody had to join something. So 6 of us were drinking beer, and one of them said, let's join the Marine Corps. And I said, let's go. Is that how you got in, John? And after the initial shock wore off, wow, I remember thinking to myself about those drill sergeants. I said, you guys ought to lighten up. Hey, man, what's going on here? And it was, I found out what was going on, and it took about 6 months training to become a platoon leader, and by that time I had fallen in love with the Marine Corps. I just thought it was the greatest thing in the world. They just broke you down and then built you in to be part of a team. And the team was it. And I loved it. And I saw a training movie about pilots. That looked even better. They were sleeping in nice beds. No foxholes. They were at the bar. They were talking with their hands. They had little white scarves on. There was a couple of blondes standing in the background. And I went, whoa, that's better than in the swamp. So I'd never been in a plane, but I signed up for Pensacola, Florida, and I met this lovely woman who we had the 6 children. We got divorced about 30 years ago, and she'd been married to the same guy, but we're very close. And so during the funeral services and all that, we really did a lot of helping each other and reminiscing and talking. Anyway, she was the love of my life, and we got married, got on a plane to go to Pensacola, the old prop plane, DC-3s, and I got airsick going to Atlanta. I got airsick going to Pensacola. Got airsick in the old SNJ for a while. But the motion sickness went away, and all of a sudden I'm doing extremely well. I'm being number 3 in my class, number 2, as we went through gunnery and bombing and night flying and formation flying and the carrier and all that stuff. Off to Texas for advanced training, and eventually got into some jets. Had my orders overseas, went to El Toro. The Marine Corps took over for their training fighter squadron, and then the Korean War is over. And now I'm in Japan in the frontline fighter squadron with some of the greatest guys in the world. Our colonel was called Trigger Long, and he was an ace in both World War II and Korea. And so I assumed he got his name Trigger for shooting down all those airplanes. So we were all drinking one night, and somebody else asked, Colonel, where'd you get the name Trigger? He said, oh, back in basic school, I was up in my room screwing around with my .45, and I shot a round off, and it went through the ceiling and almost hit the guy over me. And ever since then, they called me Trigger Long. So I knew I was home. And it was just great. I have a lot of wonderful flying stories and all the things we did and the gunnery matches, and everybody drank a lot and we were a team, and I just loved it. And I was with the major maintenance officer, Major Newport. We're out the end of the runway watching our buddies practice for the carrier. Oh, he's too high, he's too fast, you know, all that. And he turned to me and said, you know, I'm going to be a lieutenant colonel soon, going to get my own squadron. And I'm going to get nothing but the best pilots. And I was a lieutenant, and he looked at me and said, I want you. Well, that's like being ordained or something. It's just, oh. And then he said, but I wouldn't let you drink. And that's the guy I get drunk with all the time. I mean, I pretended I didn't hear it. I never, I was smart enough to not ask him, what do you mean? I just, oh. And then went on and on. And it wasn't until I got to AA that I realized, in the midst of heavy drinkers, my drinking scared them. They were just getting drunk all the time. I was going way beyond that. I was doing something much more intense, much more, and they all would look and go, wow, I don't know where he's going, but I don't want to go there. And when they came back to the States, they toned their drinking down to what was acceptable. Back here, I just continued on my way. I was an alcoholic waiting for the end to happen. I had some wonderful assignments in the Marine Corps. I was with the 1st Marine Division for a year, and I was a flight instructor. And near the end, I was in the photo squadron at Cherry Point, North Carolina, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And we were flying the F-3D radar plane and the Crusader, the photo plane. And again, it was a wonderful squadron. I was privileged to be in it. It was no lieutenant. It was all captains, a major, and a lieutenant colonel. And the disease was now ready to close the door. I wouldn't drink for 8 hours prior to flying, and I was starting to get withdrawals from not drinking. And it was happening in the airplane. And I would start to shake, and then I would start to lose my peripheral vision. Then my heart would start to race, and then I thought I was going to pass out. And there was no alcohol program. I never heard of AA. I just said, you're going to have to stay with it. You're going to have to keep doing this. I mean, I had no idea of asking anybody. So I would get in the plane, and sometimes it would be fine, and I could go fly a mission and come back, and it was just okay. But other times, I was really panicking because I thought I was going to pass out, and I didn't know, you know, and you get your heart going like that. And so I would fly sometimes with one hand on the ejection seat and the photo plane, all the picture stuff is on the stick, so you could actually fly the mission with your hand up here. And my theory, which probably was wrong, was that with this death grip, if I passed out, I go bam, and it would fire the seat up, and the chute opens automatically at 10,000 feet. I land safely. The plane crashes. Problem solved. So that's how we think. You know what I mean? And besides, there wasn't anything in the handbook about flying during alcoholic withdrawal, so I had to ad lib. Eventually, it came to an end. We were in the radar planes. There was flight of four, and I remember flying along, and I knew that I had to get out of the plane now. I don't know if you've ever been at the end of your drink, and you've been somewhere, and you have to leave now. I remember getting a haircut once, and I said, I have to leave now. Well, I'm not through. Yes, you are. And I'm out. I can't stay where I am. I'm sorry. I have to leave now. And that's what it was. I had to leave now. And there was no ejection seat. This old plane had something that opened in the bottom, and you slid out the bottom. And I was trying to remember how that worked, and I'm looking around. And then I go, oh, my God, this guy, the radar guy, he doesn't know how to fly. You can't jump out of here and leave him here. So we have a thing, if you declare an oxygen emergency, all the planes have to land at once because bad oxygen, you could pass out. So I declared, I called the flight leader, and I said, this is number three, we got an oxygen emergency here. Oh, okay, so he spotted an Air Force base nearby. We all went in. They're checking everything out. I'm at the club. I'm getting some drinks. I feel better. Okay. Nobody knows there's a problem because oxygen things do happen, and that's what you do. So nobody was making a big deal, this and that. So I get down the flight line the next day, and I took a look, and I just said to the flight leader, I'm not going to do this anymore. Now, I've been doing it for almost 14 years, and alcohol decided that I was going to give it up now. That's it. You are no longer going to fly. So I told the guy, I said, I'm not going to fly anymore. And he said, what do you mean? I said, I'm not going to do this anymore. I wouldn't explain it. So somebody else flew the plane back. I guess I rode. I don't remember. And I got back, and he said, well, you have to go tell the colonel. I went and told the colonel, and he said, what? He said, what are you talking about? This is your whole life. I said, I'm not going to do it anymore. He said, well, if you stick with that, we got to notify the commandant, and they're going to give you a new specialty, which turned out to be air traffic controller. But I only did that a year while I was in charge, so I didn't control. I just tried to show up at work. And eventually ended up in the nut ward, and a few years later I was forced out and lost my career and everything. So then I went back to the squadron. And I wouldn't look anybody in the eye. Because this is, you know, these guys are really something, and I know how they feel about me. I don't need them to tell me anything. And I agreed to do the legal work. It took about 3 months to get a new military occupational specialty. So I did all the special court martials and handled anything of a legal nature. I had my own little office, and I never looked anybody in the eye. Another captain would bring in stuff, and he would just tell me, and I would go, okay, okay, and then I would just do it. And it was 3 months of shame. I could not look at them. I knew what they were thinking. They're just going, how did that piece of junk get in our squadron? And I finally got transferred. I was so glad to get out of there. And then, as I said, eal I ended up having a grand mal seizure in the delirium tremens and went back to duty briefly in sobriety. And I had a couple years sobriety, and I was forced out of the Marine Corps. I didn't get promoted to major. And myself and my six kids went out, and that began my financial struggle in AA, which I won't bore you with, but it went on for a long time. I hate to tell new people, but I think I had about 15 years before I was even, because I'm not a very good money earner. But a thing happened 2 years ago at the Brentwood Group in California. And I've incorporated this into my story now on a regular basis because the lesson contained in it is so powerful. I was leading at Brentwood, and it's a big group, and they get somebody to come and who's been around quite a while, and they come up with a topic and talk about it for half an hour, and then people raise their hand and ask questions. You know, like Chuck would be there, and he would talk about something, and then people would raise their hands, and what a privilege to be to ask him questions. And a woman was coming to get her 30-year medallion, and her husband was driving her there, and he's not in NEA, but he goes to the meetings a lot over the 30 years. But he was just going to go have coffee, and she mentioned, well, we got a guy from Florida, he's up here, he's going to lead the meeting, Sandy Beach. And he went, was he a pilot? And she said, yeah. She said, I think I know him, tell him to come out here. So right before the meeting, I go out, and here's this guy I've never seen in my life. He looks at me and he said, in 1962, you were in a flight of four F-3D radar planes on a cross country and you declared an oxygen emergency. And all the planes landed and you never flew again. And I went, how do you know that? He said, I was in the plane with you. So, and I went, I had never seen him before. And I went, you were? And so we got together after that. I had to go in and talk. So we got together afterwards, and turns out he wasn't a radar guy. He was another pilot, been recalled from American Airlines for the Cuban Missile Crisis. His name is Jim Heth. And he retired as the second senior pilot at American. So we were the cross country. The reason it was all pilots and no radar guy was that there was a hurricane coming to Cherry Point, and the way what you do then is you take all the airplanes to a safe place, and then you drink until the hurricane goes away, and then you fly back. So there wasn't any radar guys going on that one. That was all pilots. And so he talked and talked, and I just said, wow. So I was up at Oxnard the next night at a convention, and he came up and he brought photographs from the squadron, and oh, yeah, I remember that colonel, blah, blah, blah. And then he said, did you know how popular you were in that squadron? Did you know how much it broke our hearts that you were leaving? Did you know that the colonel pulled every string he could? It almost killed him that you were leaving. And he went on and on about this. Everybody, they just knew your name. They talked about you after you left. Hope he's all right. Maybe something happened. And I said to myself, well, that's not the way I remember it. So one of us was right and one of us was wrong. He was right and I was wrong. So I had to go back to 1962 and go erase, 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 erase. All the shame, all of the people looking at me, all the feelings that I had, erase, 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 and put in the truth. And now when I think about it, I go, man, that's amazing how those guys supported me. Isn't that wonderful? That's a very pleasant memory, that three-month period during 1962. So what did I just do? I just changed my past. How do you change your past? You get rid of the lies and put in the truth. You get rid of the perception you used to have and you put in the truth. We could change almost everything. We could change everything. Because our ideas about things were wrong. Some of them were right. Most of them were wrong. Our perception was wrong, and we created a world out of our ideas. I created my little world. It was scary. There was no God in that world. I was the only one in it. It's my world. Why would I let anybody else in? I'm in charge. And that world was made of ideas. And they were put together one idea at a time as I grew up. Frightening Catholic Church, don't trust people here, everybody's better than I am, nothing's fair, if they really knew me, everybody would hate me, okay, that's a nice foundation, let's see what we can build from that. So we go. And then we got this whole package, and in AA we call it our story. We don't say our facts. This is our story. When we get up here and tell people about ourselves, we're telling them a story. Who made the story up? Me. In other words, the facts are that a family moved in next door. That's a fact. Now, in my story, a rotten family moved in next door. In my sister's story, a friendly family moved in next door. I'm in charge of the adjectives. And they were all bad. And so when you finish this package, especially us alcoholics, we start withdrawing from whatever that is out there and come into the safety of our horrible little world. And then we sit in there and suffer and make up more ideas. There's some holes up here. It's miserable in here. Okay, that'll fill that little hole. I hate everybody. That'll fix that thing around the chimney. And pretty soon, there it is. And that's what we have to break when we go see a new person. We have to smash in there because they don't know that this world they're in isn't real. It looks real. It seems real. And the whole AA program, look what it says. Old ideas, you could say old homes, availed us nothing. You got to stop living there. And so we get rid of them. The idea that somehow we can drink like other people has to be, we all know that line, smash. You see the house coming down? Smash. We got a whole step, the 10th step about being wrong. See this thing up here, right up here? But yeah, that's wrong. Take it down. Okay. Well, you're wrong about that. You're wrong about that. And pretty soon, as more light comes in, it's fun to be wrong. Oh, my God, I'm wrong. Yay, throw it away. Oh, boy. Because our ego gets over the first initial thing of not wanting to be wrong. My sponsor finally trapped me, and I went, okay. Okay, you're right. And he said, no, you're wrong. And I said, well, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. He said, say it. Do you remember the first time you tried to say I'm wrong? It wouldn't come out. It was just, I can't hear you. And then I think about Chuck. Uncover, discover, discard. Oh, I just found something else I'm wrong about. Now, what replaces that? Nothing. We're not looking to learn anything. We're just looking to get rid of all of our old ideas. Because as we get rid of them, our home gets smashed. And we're suddenly in God's home. That's how you get there. It's sitting there waiting for you. It's been there all along. He built this wonderful world. It's filled with wonderful things. I was talking to Jeff before. I said, I sit at the Yana meeting. It's a noon meeting, a club. And it's like my family. And I go there and I just watch it. I just watch. Oh, yeah, there's Henry. Holy cow, he looks better. And then I find out he got a job. Good, Henry. Oh, yeah, look at this. Uh-oh, there's trouble back there. Oh, they'll be back. We don't have to worry about them. And I'm part of this. It's all right in front of me. And I just sit there with a big smile on my face because I'm watching God's kids and God's world. And I'm seeing it with eyes that see the truth because I've smashed so many old ideas. And the centerpiece of everything is God. And we never can forget that. It is the most important word in Alcoholics Anonymous, as far as I'm concerned. And I love to spend time with God. I like to think about God. Every time I think about God, I start to smile. I just go, and I go, God, you are really amazing. I mean, like he needs to know that. You are really amazing. I can't believe this. This is this whole universe. And then I just learned about the universe. Said, you pulled that off. That is absolutely amazing. I can't believe this. And I'm around. And so I spend a lot of time alone because my brain is so funny. I like to sit there and listen to it and go, yeah. So I was really given a pretty good deal to just hang around. A lot of crazy people are like that. And other people don't understand them, but they're having a lifetime. Oh, that's just wonderful. And I would suggest if you are meditating, step one before you meditate is smile, then start. You'd be amazed how that changes everything. Or you're going to get ready to pray. Smile. Now say it. And it just comes out different because you're so happy to be talking to God. There's a big smile on your face. And we want to be happy when we're talking to God. We want to be able to honestly tell him how happy we are to be in his world. Now, one of the secrets to all of this, and I know I'm running late on time here, No, I'm not. It started at 10. Okay, I got a little extra, so I can make up some more stories. I'll probably steal one from Clancy, but he won't remember it because it was so long ago. I pay attention to everything he says. When you look at what Dr. Young said in the letters that Bill wrote to Dr. Young to make him aware of what happened after he treated Roland Hazard, that this whole fellowship sprung up as a result of him telling Roland that he needed to have a spiritual experience. And in the response back, Dr. Young goes to comment, well, I'm so glad to hear about that, and back then it was hard to talk about spiritual matters with my peers, but they understand more now, so I can talk about these matters and how God was the only conquering force for alcohol. And then he goes on to make a comment about humanity in general. And it goes something like this. He said, everyone is struggling against evil. And here we'd call it character defect. Everyone is struggling against character defects. And they always lose. That's a pretty pessimistic statement. They always lose. Unless they have one of these spiritual transformations, and they're in a society that helps them maintain that transformation. That's us. That's exactly the package that he was describing, where we can be the exception to this thing. We can be the exception to always losing. As individuals, we might well all lose. But if I see you losing, I run over and I go, you know, you're not going out that door. And you see me, you go, what's wrong? Now you tell me about that. Okay, and they get me reconnected to God. And then I help you get reconnected. And together, we all keep succeeding one day at a time. And it becomes the most amazing journey a human being could be on. And if you don't see it that way, you get a teacher, get someone to teach you how to see what's really here. That's what perception is. It is getting rid. First, you have to tell your ego that it's not very smart. And the stuff it thought up is useless. And there's nothing to figure out. There's nothing to think about. I mean, the worst thing, one of my pigeons that I'm sponsoring, and they'll go, I got this terrible situation. What are you going to do about it? I'm going to go home and think about it. And I go, no! No, you'll have five problems by the time you get through. You're not allowed to think about it. No thinking. No thinking. None. Call up all your friends. Ask them what the Rays did in the baseball game. Tell you were there. Read a book. Do something. But do not think about it. Not thinking about it is letting go. Letting go allows it to unfold the way it's supposed to. We don't have any influence on how it unfolds anyway. We just think we do. God has it all planned out. It's all going to go that way no matter what you do. And it just sounds like, doesn't mankind have any role in this? What is it all? Predetermination? It's all predestination? No man's free will, blah, 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 and all that stuff. And I go, yes, the answer is yes. It's all predestination and free will. It's all those two. Well, how the hell could that happen? How could there be both? Well, it turns out the way the events just unfold the way they're going to, and then you put adjectives on them. And with your will, you create the reality that you live in because a lousy neighbor just moved in. God didn't put a lousy neighbor there. He just put a neighbor there. But you had to exert your will on the situation, and you turned it into a terrible thing. So then you had to go home and think about how to get even with that neighbor. Maybe I could force him to leave. If I'm rude to him, he might sell his house and get out of here. So none of that was supposed to happen, but it all occurred in our head. And so if I'm willing to let go, the whole program could be summarized as letting go. And we come in and we let go of alcohol. So if we had our problems like this, when we let go of alcohol, it's one finger, drop that. And the other nine are still holding on to the rest of our lives. And we need a strong sponsor, and we need to work these steps as hard as we can to slowly pry those fingers open and all the other issues. We just aren't going to let them go. I'll let go a little bit. Okay, God, here's some lust. Are you holding back? No, no. I have a cramp in my finger. It's a cramp. I'm not trying to hold on to some of it. No. Give me that. Whoops. Is that gossip you're holding? No, I'm not holding on to gossip. No gossip over here. I gave up gossiping. Well, actually, I gave up originating gossip. Now, if someone over here wants someone over there to hear a juicy thing, and the only way to get it there is through me, like a telephone pole, I'm a mere conduit of gossip. So it's really like I don't gossip at all. It's just flowing through me on the way to the others. Do you see how it's hard to get the rest of that stuff, to let go of it? And generally, it's circumstances, embarrassment, horrible things. Okay, all right. I get out of jail. Okay. Kicking and screaming. And then Bill writes a wonderful thing in the 12 and 12. It says, a great moment is apt to occur when we see humility as something we want instead of something we have to have. Something that we want. I want to be in a position where God does everything and I just carry out his wishes. That's perfection. God said everything and I just carry out his wishes. And we get close. And of course, it's impossible to get all the way there. St. Francis came close, and his prayer certainly captures perfection as far as I'm concerned. And there's part of that prayer, I was thinking about it in terms of what happened with my daughters. Where there's hatred, bring love. Where there's wrong, bring a spirit of forgiveness. And then down at the very end, there's an interesting thing. A lot of people wonder, I'm having a hard time forgiving myself. I'm just having a hard time forgiving myself. I did some horrible things. I'm just having a hard time. How do you forgive yourself? You ever heard that question? How do you forgive yourself? Look in the prayer of St. Francis. It is by forgiving that we are forgiven. So the way we forgive ourselves is to forgive everything that ever happened to us. Everything. Whether it's the IRS or your wife cheating or your husband stealing all your money or your father did this, your mother did that. Forgive. When you're finished forgiving everybody, you will be off the hook. After all, how could you forgive yourself if you don't forgive? How could you forgive a person who doesn't forgive? So St. Francis just has it all. Everything's reduced down to, by forgiving, we are forgiven. And by dying, we awaken to life eternal. He's not talking about physical death. He's talking about the death of our ego. This is our world. This is the territory that we own, that we're in charge of. And we carve out this much, the drinking. Okay. I'm giving up that, but I'm keeping the other 3/4 of the globe I'm in charge of. Got to be in charge of something. And then slowly, there goes that. Pretty soon, you have no territory left at all. None. You're home free. That's what it looks like. I get guidance. That's why we rely on prayer and meditation, to have this intuitive channel opened. We can struggle as hard as we want to come up with the right thing to do. And then we find out if we stop thinking it up, we get quiet, smile, and sit there and see if something won't come. And then the way it happens to me is I'll tell somebody, and then it just occurred to me that I ought to go over and tell her this. It just occurred to me. That's God. That's when you got quiet, you let go, and you said, I haven't got any idea how to solve this. Not that we wouldn't talk to other people, but we also go and get quiet with everything and see if we don't get some guidance. It was, we heard that in that wonderful talk on history. They sat down and looked for guidance, and they got quiet, and Dr. Bob and Ann, Bill, and they would sit there and they'd wait for this guidance. And so this is where everything that is of tremendous value is going to come from, is by letting go. I'm not in charge. And the more you let go, the less of a burden you're carrying. When you're responsible for everything, it weighs about 600 pounds, and you go through the day going, man, I am tired. I'm exhausted out here today. And you just turn it over, and it just feels like you can run around like a little kid and going, well, where's the swing set? Well, you're not very concerned about life. No, I want to know where the swing set is. That's what I want to know. And it looks that way, but we're so efficient. When the answers are just being funneled right through, it doesn't take any energy. And it makes life so light, just light. I love the word light. It's light meaning it doesn't weigh anything, and light meaning here it comes. And I think in AA, we have the perfect path to the light. We help each other, and we just don't resist it. The hard part, pain, comes from resisting what happens. If I had resisted the murder or the death or anything like that, I would be suffering, probably be home. I wouldn't be able to come here because I resisted it. I didn't want it to happen. It shouldn't have happened. I demand it doesn't happen. This is absurd. It already happened. You see how much time we waste refusing to accept something. We're going to fight it. Somehow we're going to make it not happen. I'm going to do it. And my ego says, this is loyalty. You're being a good father with all this suffering. That's what the ego would love to get us to suffer. Oh, man, want to suffer. Aren't you suffering? You're not living right. Come over here. Let me show you. It's all, I don't know how to explain it, but let me go back to the new people, and then I'll sit down. If this sounded complicated and I didn't come up with enough stories to get the points across or whatever, it's very simple. Bill called AA an utter simplicity. It really is. You simply get a sponsor, and then you ask him one question or her. What do I do next? That's it. There's your whole plan. Don't do anything except that. Just, what do I do next? I mean, if you can't pull that off, the problem is you don't want to do it that way. You want input into how, what we're going to do, what your role's going to be and all that. Just listen to what I said. You get a sponsor, and then you say, what do I do next? And then your job is to evaluate the results of that plan compared to when you were in charge. That's your job. Every 3 months, come up and go, I'm here to report, and much to your chagrin, you're going to have to say, it's better. You're almost angry that it's better. And then you're going to get happy that it's better. And then you're going to get, the group will help you. And then eventually you're just going to turn to God. And you go, what do I do next? It's not a complicated program, is it? So if you're new, we love you. You stay, get that light. Get somebody in hand who will lead you towards it. And then you can report back to the new people the same jackpot that the rest of us had. Thank you all very much.